We won't play Name That Tune, but have you heard this before?
Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on, coming in on a wing and a prayer.
He gives me the shivers. It really does.
Yep, that's the voice of the last man alive who was on the plane that song was dedicated to. And you can hear his story today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me then for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every week here on AM 580 and FM 105.9 KMJ. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for posterity, and learn a thing along the way about what it means to really love your country. Boy, are we in for a treat today. You know, when I travel with Fresno State, I like to find veterans in the area where I'm going. And in Mesa, Arizona, I had the privilege of catching up with 92-year-old Ralph Burbridge. Boy, does he have a story to tell. And I'm going to read a little story. We'll see if Ralph can tell us if this is true or not. Maybe you've gotten this email with a picture. Sometimes I'll tell you about photos that you need to go online to kmjnow.com to look at. If ever there was a show where you need to look at the photos, this is it. You need to see what this B-17 looks like. And here's how the story goes. A mid-air collision on February 1st, 1943, between a B-17 and a German fighter over the Tunis dock area became the subject of one of the most famous photographs of World War II. An enemy fighter attacking a 97th Bomb Group formation went out of control, probably with a wounded pilot, then continued its crashing descent into the rear of the fuselage of a fortress named All American, piloted by Lieutenant Kendrick R. Bragg of the 414th Bomb Squadron. When it struck, the fighter broke apart but left some pieces in the B-17. The left horizontal stabilizer of the fortress and left elevator were completely torn away. The two right engines were out, and one on the left had a serious oil pump leak. The vertical fin and the rudder had been damaged. The fuselage had been cut almost completely through, connected only at two small parts of the frame, and the radios, electrical, and oxygen systems were damaged. There was also a hole in the top that was over 16 feet long and 4 feet wide at its widest, and the split in the fuselage went all the way to the top gunner's turret. All right, so far, does that all sound accurate?
Yeah.
Sounds familiar. February 1st, 1943. We're going to tell you where Ralph was on this plane in a minute, but let's continue the story. Although the tail actually bounced and swayed in the wind and twisted when the plane turned, and all the control cables were severed except one single elevator cable still working, the aircraft still flew, miraculously. Do you think miraculously is fair to say there?
Yeah, that's all right. It was a miracle, all right.
All right. Well, let's continue. The tail gunner was trapped because there was no floor connecting the tail to the rest of the plane. The waist and tail gunners used parts of the German fighter and their own parachute harnesses in an attempt to keep the tail from ripping off and the two sides of the fuselage from splitting apart. While the crew was trying to keep the bomber from coming apart, the pilot continued on his bomb run and released his bombs over the target. Now, you were the bombardier on this plane. Is that true?
Well, no. I think we had already bombed when that crash happened.
That makes more sense to me because you would have had a hard time keeping your speed up.
We couldn't do that, no.
All right. So, see, this is why we check the accuracy of these things making their way around the Internet. So there's one thing we've caught, but let's continue and see what else. When the bomb bay doors were open, the wind turbulence was so great that it blew one of the waist gunners into the broken tail section. You remember that?
No, I don't. Sammy Sarpolis was back there. He had a hard time getting out of that tail gunner's position. He had to have help.
Because there was nothing connecting the tail to the rest of the plane except that elevator cable, right?
As far as I know, yeah. It was a Boeing engineer said it was impossible for it to fly. Yeah.
Impossible. That's why he said it was a miracle. Well, let's continue here. So Sarpolis is stuck in the back of the plane, the tail gunner. The turn back toward England had to be very slow to keep the tail from twisting off. They actually covered almost 70 miles to make the turn home. The bomber was so badly damaged that it was losing altitude and speed and was soon alone in the sky. For a brief time, two more ME-109 German fighters attacked the All-American. Despite the extensive damage, all of the machine gunners were able to respond to these attacks and soon drove off the fighters. The two waist gunners stood up with their heads sticking out through the hole in the top of the fuselage to aim and fire their machine gunners. Does this all sound familiar?
No. The two fighters came in, and that's when one of them came into our aircraft.
So after those initial fighters, you guys didn't face any fighter opposition the rest of that time?
No, we were all well on our way home, so we were okay.
Eventually, Allied fighters intercepted the All-American as it crossed over the channel and took some of the pictures. And this is the famous picture that went all the way around. Lieutenant Bragg signaled to those fighter pilots that the five parachutes and the spare had been used, so five of the crew could not bail out. He made the decision that if they could not bail out safely, then he would stay with the plane and land it. How do you remember that coming together?
I don't remember that. Ken said that, but he may have. You said over the channel. We weren't over any channel. Mm-hmm. We were on land. This was a land to land. See, we hadn't gone across into Italy yet.
Because your first missions as a bombardier were flown out of England, but at this time you guys were based in North Africa by now.
That was our new base. It was a real change for us. You know, we as Air Force personnel, we've been used to barracks. We were in pup tents.
Uh-huh. That was a different atmosphere. Let's get the rest of this email that's making its way around and clarify that, and then we'll get to the start of Ralph's story. But a lot of you have probably read this email or heard this story, so we're getting it from someone who actually lived it. It says here that 2.5 hours after it was hit, the aircraft finally made its final turn to line up with the runway, descended into an emergency landing and a normal rollout on its landing gear. When the ambulance pulled alongside, it was waved off because not a single member of the crew had been injured. No one could believe that the aircraft could still fly in such a condition. The fortress sat placidly until the crew all exited through the door in the fuselage and the tail gunner had climbed down a ladder, at which time the entire rear section of the aircraft collapsed onto the ground. That rugged old bird had done its job. Is that what you remember?
Yeah, it fell apart after we landed, yeah. What was it, something that we did, just a simple thing and it landed. I mean, the tail fell off. Collapsed, rather. It was a long time ago.
All right, so now we've heard that story that's making the rounds, but now let's get it from Ralph Burbridge's perspective. And again, look at that picture of that B-17. In 1943, this picture went all over the world. In fact, it inspired a song that a lot of people have heard, Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer. That song would be dedicated to your crew. I know that's true. But let's go back a little bit. That's a little teaser for our listeners because we'll get to that story. Let's talk about you. You grew up in Louisiana, not the state, but the city.
Louisiana, Missouri, yeah.
I bet you've confused a few people with that over the years.
Oh, yes.
And what made you decide to enlist in the U.S. Army Air Corps?
I didn't want to walk too far. Uh-huh. No, I didn't. I wanted to fly in the Air Force.
You wanted to be a pilot?
Yeah, I wanted to, yes, but it didn't work out for me. It didn't work out for most people in those days. But by the end of the war, they were taking 80% in.
The timing was just a little off. Well, and it's funny. I've interviewed hundreds of Air Corps veterans, and I'd say 99% of them admit to me that they really wanted to be a pilot, ended up doing something else. A few of them insist that they never wanted to be a pilot, but I don't know if I believe them. So how did you end up as a bombardier?
When I washed out, I went home for a few months, and I got called up, and I got sent out to Albuquerque to bombardier school. Mm-hmm. And I completed the course there. We were assigned to a unit, so that's the way that worked out.
And this plane that now is famous the world over, the B-17 All-American, it got that name because of your pilot's background, right?
Yeah. He was a football player. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether he was he could have been an All-American.
He played for Duke?
Played for Duke. That was days when Duke was very powerful. Mm-hmm.
So he got the privilege of naming that All-American. Did you like that name?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because we had so many people on the crew were different nationalities. I mean, not nationalities, but from different nationalities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very fitting.
And you flew 52 missions in World War II, so long before you had that fateful mission over the docks at Tunis. There were some other adventures you had. And this was before B-17s were really doing anything in World War II. You guys were really trailblazers.
Oh, yeah. We were the first ones in. As I said, we flew our first mission, and we opened the air war in Europe. We from England, and of course, we flew with 12 airplanes over to Rouen, France, and back. And we were covered by the press so bad, much you couldn't believe it. You think we had won the war. Well, we were desperate for good news. You know, the Japanese had overrun us. We were not, didn't have anything. The equipment was, well, I always think about the people in the infantry. They had old leggings at that time from World War One. They were using stuff from World War One. And until they got, you know, Springfield rifles and things, till they got those Durand rifles. It was sad days. I never want to be like that again in this country, unprepared.
No doubt. And so this is August of 1942, I believe, when you flew that first mission. And now you can look back, you flew 51 other missions, so maybe it doesn't seem like a big deal. But at that time, if I do the math, you're a 22-year-old kid, and you're doing something that Americans have never done before, flying these B-17s over Europe and dropping some bombs, and it's your job to drop the bombs. Were you intimidated? Were you anxious? Were you nervous? What do you remember?
Oh, I don't know. You always had a cold sinking feeling in your stomach as you went into combat. We didn't know what to expect there. Of course, the first time in, later on, we knew because we were under fire.
And that's the thing that really marked those early missions over Europe in the air war, was the opposition fighters did a number on American bombers. What kind of opposition did you guys run into in those early missions?
Oh, of course, we were outnumbered all the time. The Germans had the Messerschmitt 109 and the Focke-Wulfs that were air-cooled engines. The Messerschmitt, of course, was a water-cooled engine. And they would bore in. When they first started over there, they tried everything. They finally, they came in on the tail. That was a mistake. Those tail, our tail gunners sat back there with 250s. They unloaded on them. So they could quit that. Then they came in on head-on attacks, 12 o'clock high. You've heard of that? Mm-hmm. Well, that's what it was, to be up here. That's the nose of the plane, 12 o'clock. Wherever the plane is, it's 12 o'clock. And they'd come in high. That's what happened there. They came in at 12 o'clock high.
On the February 1st mission, yeah. The famous one. Yeah. And if they're coming 12 o'clock high, the bombardier, you, are sitting in the nose of that airplane. Yeah. And all that's separating you from these planes is a little sheet of plexiglass, and you've got some guns up there.
Yes. At that time, the bombardiers only had a 30 caliber. But later on, when the B-17G came out, they put 250s up front, too. But that's what I had. And it was a day to remember. I had other times that were worse.
Well, we're going to have to hear about that. But first, we need to catch a little break. When we come back, we'll dive deeply into that famous mission that left the B-17 All-American hanging on by a wing and a prayer. We'll even listen to that song, as you might have heard it on the radio in 1943. If you've never seen the famous photo, go to kmjnow.com right now and take a look at it. You'll find it all on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, too. And we'll be right back with 92-year-old Ralph Burbridge after a word from our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing.
It's a centralized ABC.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too.
Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. World War II has been in the spotlight plenty this week. Wednesday, of course, was the 68th anniversary of D-Day, and they honored that in Normandy by unveiling a statue modeled after the late Dick Winters, a 101st Airborne paratrooper made famous by the Band of Brothers series. We've listened to some airborne D-Day veterans the last couple weeks, and we're going to do that again next Saturday with a 101st Airborne veteran right here in the San Joaquin Valley. Right now, though, we'll continue with 92-year-old Ralph Burbridge. To his knowledge, he is the last surviving member of the crew of the B-17 All-American, flying with the 414th Squadron of the 97th Bomb Group in North Africa, the plane that somehow limped back to its base after having its tail nearly completely severed by a German fighter on the first day of February 1943. Maybe you've received that email that's making the rounds about that mission. Ralph has confirmed some elements of that and clarified some others. We'll get back into it now to paint as clear a picture as we can. So on that day, as you recall, you guys had already dropped your bombs when these fighters come in. So you see a German fighter plane coming right at your airplane.
I'm just like, I'm sitting here by that window 6 feet away.
So, is it not giving it justice to say it was kind of like a game of chicken? There's a plane flying straight at you, and if you don't shoot it down, he's going to shoot you guys down?
I'll tell you one thing.
Yeah.
The guy that blinks is dead. Mm-hmm. So you don't blink. You pour fire into him.
So you are sitting there, gripping this .30 caliber, firing away as fast as you can, and saying a prayer that this isn't your final moment?
Well, I wasn't saying a prayer. I was probably cussing the son of a gun.
And I'm sure you weren't alone in that. What happened? You believe that you put some of those bullets in him, that whether it killed the pilot or not at that point, it debilitated that aircraft, and he crashed into the tail section.
Yeah, that's what happened. He crashed. I'm quite sure he was dead. Mm-hmm. He was dead rather than heavily wounded. He could have been either one, but he came right into us, boy. I'll tell you, he felt like he could reach out and touch him. But he crashed above and into the B-17 tails high. Mm-hmm. And he came down. You could see how it sliced. Mm-hmm. He came in there, boy.
And what now, at the time, you're in the nose of that airplane. It's hard for you to see what's happening, but what did that feel like? Was it a major jolt to the aircraft?
Jolt. Plane went up, nose rose up a little like this, and then down a little, and then Ken brought it under control, straight and level. And like I said before, the squadron grouped around us then, protect us, and we went back to base.
When did you guys realize the extent of the damage to your airplane?
Well, I didn't know till we landed, because I was up in the front of the plane.
That was probably a good thing, huh?
Yeah. You know, I think about Sammy Sorpolis, our tail gunner. He looked up. I'll tell you, he knew what was there happening.
I know you guys had flown some missions together before, and I'm sure you had a tight-knit crew, but you're about as close to your pilot, Ken, as anybody else was at that point. What do you remember about the way he handled that situation?
We handled it well. That's why we're alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ken was a great guy.
I mean, because I look at that picture, and I imagine chaos on this B-17, but I don't hear you saying that it was chaotic.
No, no. No use being chaotic about it. You're sliced up.
And you don't remember any conversation about bailing out or parachutes or anything?
I think we said, I think Ken said he could keep it under control. We didn't worry too much about it. At least I didn't, because I really didn't know how bad it was, to tell you the truth, up there in the front, see. Those waist gunners and tail gunners, they knew, and the radio gunner knew it. They really knew. And top turret, he was also the engineer on the plane. He knew it. So it was lucky we got back.
For you, ignorance was bliss?
Yeah, you bet.
So when Mr. Bragg did land that plane, and you got off the plane, and then you saw the extent of the damage, what was your reaction?
Oh, boy, I thought, how do we ever live through this? It amazed me, to tell you the truth, mm-hmm. that we could even be alive.
And I know once that picture went around, everybody was excited about it. But at the time, do you remember people reacting to your crew as you walked away? Were they shocked and astonished?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they were astonished. They were mostly airmen there, They knew the airplanes.
When did you guys, your crew, when did you realize what a worldwide phenomenon that photo had become, that people all over the world had seen it?
We didn't know much. They didn't let us know much. Mm-hmm. Didn't let us write home and tell much, mm-hmm. because I think all our letters were censored anyhow.
Yeah.
But it was just a situation where... It's just part of combat,
So you guys as a crew were just waiting to get another airplane and get back up in the air?
Well, I tell you what happened. It was wonderful for me and the navigator and I. They gave us a week off, and we caught a ride and went over to Cairo, Egypt. I tell you what we did. We flew down south on the Sahara Desert, and then we just rode hardly any altitude over those sand dunes, I remember bumping, because we had to stay under radar again. The Germans were over there. Of course, the British were in the east, their troops were saving the Suez Canal. They had to have that. We landed over in Cairo, stayed over there a week, went down to Alexander. We had a nice vacation.
All right.
Yeah.
So not only did you survive in that miraculous mission, but you got some time off. Do you remember when you first heard Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer and that someone had dedicated it to you?
I don't even remember. It's been so long ago.
But you did hear that someone had dedicated that to you guys.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they dedicated it. And it was Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer, too, believe me.
Well, let's listen to it. If you were alive during the 1940s, you probably remember the song. But if you, like me, weren't born yet back then, maybe you need a little context, as I do. If you had been listening, perhaps even to this very radio station in 1943, you might have heard Eddie Cantor singing this song, a song he dedicated to pilot Ken Bragg and the entire crew of the All-American, including Ralph Burbridge, who you're hearing from today. Let's take that time machine back 69 years now.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show, what a fight. Yes, we really hit our target for tonight. And we limp as we sing through the air. Look below, there's our field over there. With our full aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Folks, this is Eddie Cantor telling you that every day our boys are coming in on a wing and a prayer. They risk, many of them give their lives for victory in the air. Surely the least that we can do on the home front is to lend Uncle Sam our dollars for war bonds. No matter what we've done before, We must do more right now. Figure out the total of your family income, the money you need for necessary living expenses, and the extra for more war bonds through a payroll savings plan. Yes, figure it out for yourself, and you'll find that you can increase your purchases of war bonds every week or every payday. Your investment in victory and peace. One of our planes was missing. 2 hours overdue. One of our planes was missing with all its gallant crew. The radio set started humming. We couldn't hear a word, and suddenly through the humming, this is what we heard. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show! What a fight! Yes, we really hit our target for tonight. And we sing as we limp through the air. Look below, there's our field over there. With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord. We're coming in on a wing and a prayer.
That's Eddie Cantor spinning the story of the All-American into song for the War Bond Drive in 1943. He said, one motor gone. I think you had more than just one engine down.
He gives me the shivers. It really does. I'm not kidding you. It went down the bottom of my head. I had something go down my spine.
Just now, listen to that.
Oh, yeah. I don't like to think about that thing too much, I'll tell you.
No, I don't blame you.
Another thing that came out of that, not just that song, and of course they made a movie after that with the same title, but your 414th Bomb Squadron. They adopted a new logo because of your plane that day.
I don't know much about that, the logo, you know. I know they did it. And I had some, that new logo came in.
The dog sitting on the tail with the slice through, just like your plane. So that's another image you can find at kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you said you had worse missions than that one, so I want to hear about those. But I'm sure I'm not the first guy to ask you about the time that your tail almost got sliced off.
Yeah.
When you think back about that, you just told me you don't like to think back about it, but when you do and you realize how close your whole crew came to not being around,
yeah,
what does that do to you? Where does your mind go in a situation like that?
You know, I think about all the guys that went down. You know, squadron is very cohesive. We stuck together. I remember one time we had a guy who was a replacement for a plane that went down. I can't remember what point it was in my career, but it was a new crew. He went down on the first mission, no chutes. Mm. No chutes. And, well, that's the way it was in air war, World War II. Mm. I guess never air war.
Well, and you say that's the way it is. So how do you live with that on a daily basis? And I mean, were you scared when you take off for a mission? Were you concerned that you might not come back?
Everybody was. Well, we knew the time. We saw our own crews go down. Mm-hmm. The friends, you know, close friends. Some of them you went to school with. I don't mean public schools. I mean Air Force schools, you know, bombardier school. And of course, you're pretty close to the navigator. You sit almost next to him, you know. He sat behind you on the left side of the plane. Yeah, that was a time long ago.
Has it hit home over the years? You talked about flying that first mission in Europe and how the press was everywhere because America needed a good story.
Yeah.
And that mission where your tail got sliced off, that was kind of the same deal. It seems like the morale of the entire country was picked up when they heard how miraculously that mission had unfolded. Did you ever get a grasp after the war of how significant that was and how much that meant to the country?
No. Too many things were happening. As you pick up the newspaper or hear the news on the radio, it took a long time for the United States to finally build up, you know, a war machine.
Yeah.
I'm hoping today, I know it's necessary to cut back on the military, but I hope they don't cut it too much. I never want to see our young men go in combat the way we were.
I don't want to dwell too long, but one more question on that photograph, because that's one of the most recognized photographs of World War II, particularly regarding the Air Forces. Does it give you pride when you see that photo and you know that you're in the nose of that airplane? Does it humble you? What does that do to you when you see that photo?
Oh, I really don't know. I just knew it happened, you know. That's a part of war.
Yes, indeed, part of war, but also one of those little stories in the midst of war, in the middle of widespread catastrophe and tragedy, that can end up taking on meaning far greater than just the survival of a bomber crew and the salvaging of an aircraft. We're not done with Ralph Burbridge yet. When we come back, some of the other close calls this bombardier endured during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after a few more thoughts from our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, JennAir, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC. Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time to continue with 92-year-old Ralph Burbridge. He would go on to earn a degree from the prestigious journalism school at the University of Missouri. His time in the newspaper business included a stint at the San Luis Obispo Tribune. He would eventually spend 18 years as a vocational rehabilitation specialist at the Veterans Administration in Seattle. He spends most of the year in the Northwest now, but I caught up to him in Mesa, Arizona when I was down there for the WAC baseball tournament. We're going to hear about some more close calls as well as his interactions with the famed pilot of the Enola Gay, Paul Tibbetts. We've already heard about the B-17 All-American and how it came in on a wing and a prayer. This is one week where you absolutely have to go online at kmjnow.com and see those photos to back this story up. Now, you said that that was not your worst mission. That was not the scariest that you experienced. And I think you've written something here about another one that really came to mind for you.
Down two more times.
Well, let's hear the stories.
Well, we were shot up, but we got across, we were bombing Italy at that time.
Foggia? Is that what you're bombing, Foggia?
Yeah, Foggia. The scariest thing I had happen is I was sitting there, and again, We had the Germans were coming in at 12 o'clock high. I had this bullet miss me just a few inches, you know, go right by my left ear above the navigator's head. Well, we carried extra ammunition, 50 caliber. And in those bullets, they were a big, strong bullet. One of them was armor-piercing. One of them was an incendiary. And one of them was just a regular bullet. And this doggone German bullet landed in the incendiary and set it off flame. It didn't go all the way through, but just opened it up, and all that smoke came up. The navigator and I couldn't see. We didn't know what was going on. You know, when you're blind, it's really confusing. So Harry, I said, Harry, let's go get out of here. He grabbed the ammunition box, that spare ammunition box, threw it down the escape hatch. And that cleared it up. And Ken said, he called up there again and said, oh, we're okay.
Well, it says, I'm going to read what you wrote here. Let's see. So just as you described, a fighter plane came in at 12 o'clock high, the sun at his back so you couldn't see him. When you finally did see him, he was pouring bullets at you. A bullet the equivalent of a 30 caliber came past my head and penetrated an ammunition box filled with incendiaries. So that's where that thick, acrid smoke came from, and you could hardly see. And as you write here, however, it did not explode. The navigator had the presence of mind and enough time to throw it overboard. But then you say that two of your engines were shot and smoking, so the co-pilot shut them down. You were flying on the two remaining engines over Italy, so you thought you would go down for sure. And when you strapped on the parachutes and opened the escape hatch door, you looked down and you saw you were right over Mount Vesuvius.
Yeah, I remember that. That was scary. I didn't want to parachute into a volcano.
You said, I'm not jumping right here.
No.
So that's what you told the pilot, but you're still losing altitude. So what eventually happened there? It said you couldn't make it back to the base, so you landed it somewhere else at a place called Bone. That sounds pretty hair-raising, because the first time you have no clue how badly damaged your plane is. This time, you know that things are not good. What do you think got you through that situation?
Oh, I don't know. You get so you can survive anything when you're in combat. One thing, I think that, the squadron's really tight. Men are tight. Mm-hmm. And you never let the squadron down. Never.
But you didn't want to be able to say that you parachuted into a volcano?
No, not hardly.
Let's see it. And you said there were more close calls. You write about another one here where you flew out of Africa. You had two engines disabled by flak. When the flak exploded, it would shake the plane. And flying through that was very frightening. I imagine that's especially frightening if you're the bombardier, because the one that sees it.
You got all that visibility you see around you. You're just sitting up there in a bubble. What would happen is, I remember the Germans, on their batteries of 88 millimeters, they would box it, four of them, and you had to go through that flak, and it would burst. It was black. And for about 3 or 4 years afterwards, I would be dreaming about that stuff exploding in front of you.
And people say, well, why can't you dodge it? But if you're flying in formation, you've got to fly right through it.
Yes, you do. You've got to maintain it, especially if you're a bombardier and you're looking down and seeing some of that flak too as you down there see. And we had this wonderful bomb site, Norden bomb site. You could really line them up. I think our bombing was very accurate in World War II. We didn't do any night bombing. The British, they tried day bombing. They got shot all to pieces, and they went to night bombing. We flew it right at them.
What would you say was the most difficult or challenging thing about being a bombardier?
Oh, I think, actually, after World War II, I would dream about the war, flak. I'd always see flak. I never had the... dreamed about fighters coming in, but they were there. Oh boy, they came in. They were good pilots, the Germans, in the early part of the war, at least.
Did you feel a responsibility because of the unique job that you had to drop those bombs on the correct target?
On the target, yes. You're putting your life on the line, you're putting the crew's life on the line, and you want to hit the target. And I never looked up. Now that bomb site. So those crosshairs were on the target, never.
And I understand there were some hazards to that job, too. I read here that one of the most painful things you had to endure happened when you'd fire your machine guns, and sometimes the hot shell casings would fall into your boots.
Oh, yes. The government, the United States government, had these big furry boots, and they were loose on your legs. And the darn shells, the casings would go down in there. And boy, I'm telling you, your legs were burning at the same time you were in combat. It was horrible. Now, the British, their boots were tight. Mm-hmm. They were sheepskin lined, too. But they were tight, and that didn't happen. They were better prepared that way than we were.
And the implication is you can't do anything about it, because if you take the time...
You can't. You're in combat, whether you're over the bomb set or whether you're firing a gun. You can't. You just have to sit there and burn. And boy, I'm telling you, it was horrible.
Is it hard to believe now that you flew 52 missions in those kind of conditions and survived them all?
Yes, it is. I'll tell you, I don't know how. I'll never know how I got through that. I'll never know. And another thing we had to worry about when we flew in from Africa over to Italy was, we got to shot up and go down the darn sharks. Scared to death. I was scared to death and still am of sharks. I always thought, I thought if I got killed by a bullet, that was one thing, but to have a darn shark have his dinner off me is, I couldn't tolerate that.
So you didn't want to be ditching in the water with all those sharks down there?
Oh, no. Sometimes rubber rafts, you never can get into them. It's according to how the plane lands on the water.
Did you ever have to deal with losing someone from your crew?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had one man killed and two wounded. That's the way war is,
I've had some guys that lost buddies, and it really got to them. Other guys tell me they purposely tried not to get too close to anybody because they were concerned about that happening. But it seems to me that your crew was pretty tight.
Yes, we were. But all crews are tight, whether they try not to get close to each other or not. You got to depend. Every man depends on every other man. Otherwise, you don't survive.
Do you remember what it felt like to have flown those 52 missions as a bombardier and then find out that you were going to get to come home again? What was that like for you?
Yeah, I was very happy about that. I volunteered for two missions. I guess I must have been crazy.
Because you hit 50 and you were eligible to come home.
Yeah, I was eligible at 50. But the time I went, they were short. They needed to bombardier, and I went.
A name that people who know World War II will recognize, Paul Tibbetts. Now, you knew Paul Tibbetts early in the war when you guys were flying those first bombing missions over Europe. A lot of times he was the pilot right next to your plane, right?
Well, let's see. He was the squadron commander. When I got to go home from Europe, Paul had been pulled out, and I flew home with him.
Well, and the reason he was coming home was because they had a special purpose for him stateside that he needed to train for.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think they started on that mission, that atomic mission to Japan quite early.
And I'm sure you've read plenty about what he did and what he went through. Can you imagine what it must have been like for him? I mean, you carry a burden as a bombardier, not knowing what those bombs are going to do when they hit the ground. But for him to have flown that mission, do you have any idea how big a burden that must have been on him?
Have no idea, but he didn't seem to let it faze him. Mm-hmm. None of the crew.
What impressed you about him and the time you spent around him?
Oh, he was really a nice fellow. He was a good commander. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in his squadron, see, so I really don't know. I wasn't as close to him as I would be if he would have been our squadron commander.
When you came home from World War II, after all those missions and all those days and not knowing if you were going to have a life after this, did you have a new attitude, a new outlook on life, having been through what you went through?
Yeah, I was glad to be alive, like any guy that flew in World War II, in combat in World War II, rather.
And I looked around on your wall, and there's, of course, the famous photo of the B-17 All-American. There's also a picture of you and a Distinguished Flying Cross and an Air Medal and some of your other decorations that you received. When you look at that and the memories come flooding back for you, what are you most thankful for? What do you value the most?
Oh, I'm thankful for being alive, but I don't, it's just there now, and I've seen it so much that it's just there.
You went on to have four children. You've got grandchildren, great-grandchildren. What do you want future generations of America to know about World War II and what you and guys like you did?
Well, I think history should, I think they should know the history of World War II. They get that in high school and in college. So they should be well aware of the number of people that were killed. You know, the Russians lost an awful lot of men. The Germans lost 4 million. I think we lost about 450,000. It was a huge death rate, huge. I think the Russians lost 7 million men.
There have been estimates that as many as 60 million people worldwide died during that time period. Is there one thing that you would say you're most proud of?
Oh, I'm proud of serving my country like anybody that has done that. Proud of serving it. You know, I would never change that. Never change that.
Well, and I guess that's the other question I have for you. When something as extreme as that mission happens and it's so miraculous that you all survived, I would imagine that at some point someone would want to get you guys back together and reminisce about that.
Well, we had reunions. Mm-hmm. I was president 4 years. We'd get together. We'd have a bomb group reunion every year.
How long did it take when you saw those guys from your crew for somebody to start talking about that photo and that mission?
Oh, then it was just another mission.
Yeah?
Just another mission.
Well, anything else you think we ought to know?
Well, if you'd interviewed me years ago, I could probably remember more than I can in 92.
That's understandable. I guess the question then, if you're 92, is what keeps you going?
I don't know. Whatever it is, it does keep me going.
When I read that account of that mission and used the word miraculous, you agreed with that wholeheartedly. Do you feel like with that and the other close calls that you survived that there was somebody looking out for you?
I guess it was. Yeah, my father died when I was 10. I grew up in a very religious home, so I guess there was somebody looking after me, or I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. That's what I feel about that.
Well, I'm pretty sure anyone who heard you tell the story, or anybody who's even seen that photo of your B-17, is ever going to dispute that. Ralph Burbridge, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it. If you haven't seen the picture yet, go to kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Be sure to tune in again next week when I revisit D-Day and beyond with a paratrooper here in Fresno who was there for all of it. I think we might as well bring this show in for a landing with a little more Eddie Cantor in that song the plane we heard about today was dedicated to. Thanks so much for spending your Saturday with us. I'm Paul Leffler reminding you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes right around you, and you have no idea what they've done for our freedom. Here comes a little bit of that song again. Join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
And our trust in the Lord. We're coming in, we're coming in, we're coming in. Oh.